Since George Washington was first sworn in as our nation's first president in April 1789 in New York City, a lot has changed about Inauguration Day. Today, it's an iconic affair held outdoors in January at the Capitol, with the official swearing in by a Supreme Court justice, the incoming president's speech, the walk down Pennsylvania Avenue, and then galas and balls into the wee hours of the morning. But Inauguration Day hasn't always been full of such trappings. A lot has changed throughout history. This morning, to help guide us, we welcome popular historian Kenneth C. Davis, the New York Times bestselling author of Don't Know Much About History, and most recently, Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. Kenneth C. Davis joins us to discuss inaugural firsts, as well as the great and not so great moments from inaugural pasts. Kenneth, always great to have you here. Thank you very much.
And it's always my great pleasure to be with you. And it is the closest we get to a Royals moment, Joe. You know, we don't have too many of them in America, but every 4 years we get to have this pomp and pageantry that probably quite a few of the founding fathers wouldn't have liked.
Why do you think they would not have liked it? Because it is too ceremonial?
I think it's too regal for some of them. Would have been too regal for some of them. Certainly, somebody like Thomas Jefferson, who disliked anything that reeked of monarchy. He actually, in fact, stopped delivering the annual message to Congress, what we now call the State of the Union address, in person, because he thought it was too much like the king addressing Parliament, and he didn't want to make that connection. So he mailed his in, and the clerk read it. And that's part of that image that early presidents and certainly the men who formed the Constitution and formed the presidency really didn't want an American king. So Washington, when he goes the first time, you know, it's a fairly simple thing in terms of the Constitution. It's only a sentence. It's a fairly short sentence. And that's it. The Constitution doesn't say anything about who has to give it, whether it's a Supreme Court justice. It doesn't say too much about all the other trappings of the inauguration afterwards, an address, none of that. That's all tradition that's been built up. But it is a fascinating one because it does put a stamp on so many presidencies.
In this case, of course, it is a re-election. But many times when it is a transfer of power from one person to another, there's a very powerful feeling in that this person was guiding the country at 11:59 and this person is guiding it at 12:01.
It is an extraordinary thing, and the first couple of times that happened, with Washington, for instance, going to Adams, it was all new. And then when Adams went to Jefferson, that was new and it had its own little complications, which I will discuss in a second, because it wasn't as pretty as we might have liked. But one of the most extraordinary must have been in 1797 when Washington hands the reins over to John Adams and Thomas Jefferson is also there, being sworn in as the vice president, because in those days the election went to the man with the most votes, and the second place finisher became vice president. And that's what happened in the 1796 election, the first really contested election. So you had this extraordinary moment in Philadelphia, by the way. Washington, D.C. was not yet built. You have this extraordinary moment where you have George Washington, the outgoing president, Thomas Jefferson, the incoming vice president, and John Adams, the incoming president. Adams, by the way, made very sure he rode to the inauguration in a very simple coach, because it's exactly what I was talking about, this Royals moment. He had been criticized as being a monarchist, largely over a debate over what to call the president, and that was one of the chief complaints against him by a very, very bitter and vitriolic partisan press in those days. So he made sure that he rode to his inauguration in a very simple coach, nothing too fancy, just to avoid that appearance of being too regal. So image has always mattered. But you're right, going the first time around with that exchange of power, especially sometimes when it's not been a happy exchange of power, it is an extraordinary moment. The one that pops right into my head, of course, is Jimmy Carter turning the reins over to Ronald Reagan, and that moment of incredible symbolism that almost at the moment Reagan is inaugurated, the announcement is made that Iran has released the hostages. Of course, this was the hostage takeover in Tehran that bedeviled Jimmy Carter during his presidency. And there was always some suggestion that the Reagan people had somehow arranged that or put it off, and there's been never any evidence to confirm that or make any sense of it.
You talked about the inaugural a moment ago of taking place in Philadelphia. When was it first held in Washington?
That would have been in 1801 for Thomas Jefferson. John Adams was the first president to live in what became known as the White House, but he was inaugurated in Philadelphia and then moved to Washington, D.C., which was then a pretty muddy mess, a kind of small town without much going on. His wonderful wife, Abigail Adams, writes about moving into this drafty house without much plaster on the walls yet, and her complete unhappiness at seeing that it was built by slave labor. She and her husband were not fond of slavery, and of course it was such a part of the American presidency at the beginning. And it's a reminder, of course, that this people's house was absolutely built with enslaved labor.
You did mention that when George Washington was inaugurated, it was in April. We have this date sort of ingrained in our minds as January 20th. When did that switch and become permanent?
A fairly recent piece of history. After Washington, Washington was not inaugurated until late April because Congress, some things never changed, didn't get its act together, and there wasn't a quorum. Enough congressmen hadn't arrived in New York yet for a quorum, and so they had to delay Washington's inauguration until there was a quorum. Then after that, it was set as March 4th and was March 4th for a very, very long time. That created a problem because, of course, we elect the president in November, and the decision is finalized usually in December, and then you have a long lame duck period. During the 19th century, that didn't matter too much until Abraham Lincoln was elected in 1860, and there was this long stretch between his election and taking the inauguration in March of 1861. That was the first time that this was a crisis. In those days, of course, people did move more slowly. Things didn't happen. You didn't have to respond to a crisis as quickly. It became a bigger issue in 1933 during the Great Depression. Franklin D. Roosevelt had been elected, but he could really do nothing as the president-elect. And Herbert Hoover's ability to respond to the crisis was somewhat handcuffed by his lame duck status. So that was when they decided we better move this up from March to January, where it is. And it was for Roosevelt's second inauguration that the 22nd Amendment was ratified and then and put into effect. So that's when it moved to January 20th, which we should mention this year, of course, January 20th falls on a Sunday. So Barack Obama will be taking the oath of office privately on Sunday, the 20th, as required by the Constitution. And Monday's inaugural ceremonies will be the public ceremony, but he will have already taken the oath of office 24 hours before. This issue had come up before a number of times in American history. What happens when the inauguration day falls on the Sabbath? Because certainly in the 19th century, it was even more thought of as more sacred a day. Today, I think most people would say, "Well, why can't we do it on a Sunday?" But it still is, a leftover of our Puritan heritage that we don't do such things on the Sabbath.
And interesting to note that this will actually, by the time we see this on Monday, this president will have taken four oaths of office.
That's right. It's a curious little quirk of things. Of course, in 2009, when he took it the first time, Barack Obama took the oath, but Justice Roberts had sort of mangled the oath a little bit, and so they did a do-over, a mulligan, you might call it, in the White House a little bit later, just to make sure they were completely covered. Nobody seriously suggested that Barack Obama wasn't president at that moment. And then this year, of course, as we've just mentioned, he'll take it twice again, once on Sunday in private and once publicly on Monday, which, by the way, is also Martin Luther King Day, as it's celebrated as a national holiday. King, of course, born on January 15th, but we're celebrating it on the third Monday in January. And the symbolic significance is not lost on the Obama White House. Barack Obama will use two Bibles for his oath-taking. One is Abraham Lincoln's Bible, and one is Martin Luther King's Bible, which was loaned by the King family. So a nice confluence of events on this day and this tremendous history, and of course all thinking about Lincoln with the movie out and the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, and of course Martin Luther King Day, a new memorial to King on the Washington Mall, and certainly many reminders of one of the great speeches in American history, I Have a Dream. I don't know if Martin Luther King could have even dreamed in 1968 that someday a black man would be holding his Bible and taking the oath of office.
Ken Davis is our guest. We are talking about presidential inaugurations, and his book is Don't Know Much About the American Presidents, which is new and out from Hyperion. When you mention the Bible, is it stated that it must that the oath must be taken on a Bible?
Not only is it not stated, there have been those who said that it has no place in this oath taking, but that's where the Second Amendment comes in. Of course, Article 2 of the Constitution is where the oath of office is stated. As I mentioned, it's a simple sentence. There's not much to it, and not much else to say what should happen at the inaugural. It certainly doesn't mention taking it, swearing it, or affirming it. You get the choice to affirm the oath, because in those days to swear was considered an offense to some Christians, and I believe it was Franklin Pierce, who's the only president to actually affirm the oath of office rather than actually swear it. And certainly no mention of Bible, no mention of the words "so help me God" either, which now are pretty rote part of the swearing in. The legend is, or myth, I suppose, is that Washington said these words. There is actually no contemporary evidence that he did. In fact, accounts of his swearing in don't include the words at all. This was something that was introduced much later in the 19th century, and even on some of the official Senate websites, you'll see that Washington said this, and his tradition carried on ever since. That has been really questioned very seriously by a lot of historians. Certainly, Washington was a Christian. He talked about God and providence in his inaugural address, but there's nothing to suggest that he actually used the words, "so help me God," when he took the oath, which, of course, aren't part of the Constitution. Now, the Constitution also has a First Amendment that tells us the government can't tell us what to believe and what not to believe, so the president is certainly free to say, "so help me God," that's his First Amendment right, but he can't be compelled to say it, and that's the double-edged sword of the First Amendment.
What does the oath actually say? What is it conveying?
Well, the most essential idea in the oath of office is that the president is going to protect and defend the Constitution. There's not a lot about other things that he is supposed to or not supposed to do, but it is a fairly brief and simple sentence. And as I'm rifling through my copy of the Constitution, which I keep on my desk, I'll give you the full text of it, because there's not much to it, and that's why it's over pretty quickly on Inauguration Day. The Constitution's fairly clear on what the president is supposed to say. It's a simple sentence, and it's in Article 2 of the Constitution, which lays out the powers and responsibilities of the president, but it's fairly simple. It says, "Before he enter on the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. That's it. It's not too flowery and not a lot of specifics about what that actually means. To execute the office of the president, you know, there's been 225 years of history now that shows that presidents sometimes stretch that a great deal. And that's, of course, one of the things about the presidency. There have been these tremendous swings in power. We've had very, very weak, ineffectual presidents, particularly in the 19th century before the Civil War and later in the 19th century after the Civil War. And, of course, presidents who made us worry about the imperial presidency, that too powerful, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Richard Nixon, Lyndon B. Johnson. So there's always been a swing in the power of the presidency and the ability of these men to execute that office.
I think of the inaugurations of my lifetime. I remember when Jimmy Carter was taking the ride from the Capitol to the White House and got out of the car, and what a gasp that was of how unusual that was. Was that the first time anyone had done that?
That was the first time the president had gotten out of the car. Of course, in the we have to go back a long, long way to the times when presidents. First of all, the idea that there was a parade at all and walking from the White House to the Capitol was all these traditions piled up as time went by. But he was the first president to walk entirely from the Capitol to the White House in the parade following the swearing-in ceremony. And this is, of course, January of 1977, when Mrs. Carter and Jimmy Carter make that long walk. And, you know, it was a little bit of a surprise to people, but on the other hand, it was Carter saying, I'm going to be a man of the people, a contrast to that idea of the imperial presidency. And, of course, after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, that ride became a much more serious security issue. And that's why this was such a shock to us to see the president doing this. And even today now, when the president rides, for the most part, is that obligatory, it's kind of the kabuki ritual of the inauguration. Somewhere along the line, they stop the car and the president gets out and walks a little while and shakes some hands along the way. But when Carter did that in 1977, it was pretty surprising, but it was his way of announcing, I'm going to be a man of the people, I'm going to do things my own way, and I'm going to put off these trappings of this office and be accessible to the people. And of course, it was a nice gesture, and the symbolism was appropriate. It did not help Jimmy Carter's presidency in the long run.
Also, I remember, I guess it was Ronald Reagan's second inaugural, where it was just too cold.
That's right. Reagan has the distinction of the warmest inaugural on record, his first time, and then the coldest. I think the recorded temperature was 7 degrees in the Capitol that day, and so they moved most of the people they could fit into the Capitol Rotunda for the swearing-in, and it was a cold day. Interesting also, that was another year that the 20th fell on a Sunday, and so Reagan also took the oath privately in the White House on Sunday, and then he went off to do something very interesting. I don't know if you're a football fan. I remember it. He went to the map room, and via a live satellite feed, he flipped the coin for the Super Bowl.
Oh, that's right.
And I forget who actually won. It was the 49ers and the Dolphins. I forget who won the coin toss. I think it was the 49ers, but they also won the Super Bowl. So I don't know if there's any replay of that particular Sunday. Well, it won't happen this year because the Super Bowl is much later. But interesting that the Super Bowl fell in January. It doesn't anymore. And then Ronald Reagan flipping the coin. So a little piece of true inaugural trivia there.
Well, there's a lot of fascinating facts about the American presidency in your new book. It's Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. It is published by Hyperion. Ken Davis, it's always a pleasure to have you here. I thank you very much for sharing with us. Have a great inaugural day, both of them.
Thanks a lot, Joe. We'll be listening to hear if we have any of those ringing phrases that will go down in history, like the better angels of our nature. Lincoln's poetry is still, in my mind, the greatest inaugural addresses ever.
Kenneth C. Davis's new book is Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. The book is published by Hyperion. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.